This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
This is the Johnstone Podcast. Conversations with interesting people about life, death, and other things. The idea for this podcast came to me while I was recording the second and most recent series of Hospice Waikato's Last Breath podcast. I'd been asking friends and acquaintances if I could record their perspectives on death for a special episode, and hoping for around 10 minutes per person, I got nothing less than an hour and a new podcast to boot. I'm Andrew Johnstone, and this is the Johnstone Podcast. In late 2025, I interviewed Cambridge filmmaker Matt Hicks about his film The Tavern for the Cambridge Museum's Voices of Cambridge Oral History Archive. I didn't get all the info I needed, so recently Matt and I met outside the Clements. The swankiest gig in town, the Clements used to be the Masonic, a notorious dive that provided the inspiration for the film. Once we were done, we hopped into his car and spent 2 hours driving around town, talking about all sorts of things. The hardest thing about this episode? Editing it down to 58 minutes.
My name's Matt Hicks. I am a Cambridge-born and bred filmmaker. I am the guy behind The Tavern film. The Tavern is a Cambridge-shot comedy about five small-town guys who have a race against time to save their beloved yet run-down tavern from an evil Ponsonby property developer with sinister plans. We had our first screening here, our red carpet premiere at the wonderful Tivoli Cinema here in Cambridge on May the 26th, 2025.
So Matt, my first question is, you've been working on this film for 6 years. It's taken up all your time, it's taken huge resources, and you finally got it finished, and it's your big night. You've booked out the Tivoli, people are going to be seeing it for the first time. How are you feeling? Do you have an inkling that it's going to be successful, or are you sitting on the fence?
I have an inkling that it's going to be successful because, as you said, you know, it's taken us 6 years to do it, and I feel we've invited the right crowd tonight that will get it. And I've had a lot of time to think about it and how it could be received. I think it's going to go well. And if it doesn't, if it absolutely goes down like a cup of sick, it won't matter because nobody's expecting anything.
The three screenings finish and people start coming out of the cinema. Are you nervous?
When people are coming out of the cinema, you're always nervous. It doesn't matter if it's the first screening or a screening 6 months down the line. You know, you're always nervous because every crowd is different. But when you kind of see them coming and you make awkward eye contact with them and they give you a grin, you know that they've enjoyed it, you know. When they come up and shake your hand and tell you what they thought, those are just things that money can't buy, you know. That is why you do it, you know.
Did you feel validated after the screening at the Tivoli?
Yes. Yeah, 100%. I know you probably shouldn't seek validation, that's not why you do it, but it is good, you know. The whole fame thing, you know, not that like we're super famous or anything like that, but fame is a good thing in my kind of thinking, because it means a lot of people have seen your art, you know, and appreciated it, you know, talked to others about it, you know. Sometimes it's weird, you know, like you've had this as well, Andrew, where somebody will come up to you in the street and say, hey Matt, hey Andrew, and start talking to you like they know you and you've got no idea. But that's kind of like a really beautiful thing because they feel they've got a comfortability with you, you know, and I love that, you know. It's nice. It's nice to affect people's lives for the positive, you know. There's so much stress in the world. There's so much just mundane nonsense we've got to do from 9 to 5. So I'm glad after 5 I can give them a little bit of a giggle make them laugh, make them feel, alleviate some stress. You know, that's what gives me satisfaction, you know. It was a cool night. It was a mixture of nerves and excitement. We had, you know, a very pro audience of cast, crew, friends and family at 5:30, all three screens booked out. And then all three screens booked out at 7:30 for what I call our mongrel influencer premiere. So all the key drinking influencers from all the prominent Waikato towns, Cambridge, Te Aumuru, Morrinsville, Matamata, etc., etc., sold a bunch of piss, and the piss really settled my nerves. It was a great night that ended at 4 a.m. with us dropping a man to go milk his cows out to some random place in Te Aumuru. But yeah, memories forever. Beautiful.
The film dominated your life for the last few years. Has it put you off the idea of making another one?
No. I'm from you know, farming stock out Mangatauturi, you know, and any time that anything feels too hard, I think about, like, you know, my parents getting out there in the rain, like, actually doing hard work, you know. I'm like, sending a couple of emails here and there is nothing compared to what they've done. So when it gets too hard, I just recheck myself and realise that it's not. It's entertainment, it's fun, it's not too hard.
The film has been screening non-stop ever since, somewhere in the country, hasn't it?
Yeah, so we're one of the rare films that actually made it into the next year. So we screened in both 25 and 26. And, you know, we've been to all these cinemas around New Zealand, and some are more special than the others. They're all special in a way. But this is, Tivoli, this is the home of the tavern, you know. There were discussions early in the piece where somebody was trying to get us to premiere it in Hamilton. Somebody was trying to get us to premiere it in Te Aumuru. But I just could not do that. It had to be Cambridge. If somebody asked me to premiere it in Los Angeles, I'd say no. Like, it had to be here, you know. Like, it's a community film inspired by the community, so it had to have its first screening here. That was just essential for me.
You said that you made sure you had the right people here for the opening night. Watching the clips on YouTube, the after clips that you do after people come out of the cinema and you ask them about the film, the Cambridge one in particular is especially interesting. So Cambridge has this image of a conservative town.
Yeah.
And yes, you had your mischief types coming out of the cinema, but you also had a lot of very well-dressed, older women who are well-spoken.
Yes.
And they're just raving.
Yeah, I think there's two different types of people that enjoy the tavern. There's some people that enjoy the dick fart joke element of it, you know. Like, we've got this one scene where a horse defecates on another horse, you know, and I had this...
Always fun.
I had a mate that was like, far out, bro, like, that was funny, like, when the horse shat on the other horse, like, ha, ha, ha. You know, you've got those kind of people that enjoy that kind of base surface level humour, which is fine. And then you've got those people, like you were talking about, the well-dressed, articulate, educated types, you know, that understand you're kind of like satirizing rural bogan fuckwits. So yeah, it's cool that you can kind of, like, you know, appeal to both audiences, you know. Just because you are a smart, well-read person doesn't mean you can't enjoy a bit of lowbrow humor from time to time, you know. It's kind of like a fit person enjoying a monthly Big Mac, you know. It's a little bit of a treat, a little bit of escapism. What I've really loved after, you know, premiering in May is a few people have said to me, oh, I've never been to that cinema, and I've gone a couple of times since. So we had some people that weren't usual cinema goers. I'd see them coming on other nights watching the Formula One Brad Pitt movie, which was out at the time. I love that as well, you know. Like, as a filmmaker, I hate the idea of people kind of watching it on a phone or a computer. You know, you're not rigging things at 2 a.m. and getting the perfect shot, lighting it perfectly for people not to enjoy it on a big screen. I love people laughing together in a communal setting. It's so cool in a way that we've been able to attract some non-traditional cinema goers to our local cinema. It feels good. So this is the Grand Masonic Bar and Hotel, aka the Mud. So in here, now Clements Hotel, this is where I first met an icon of New Zealand music and an icon of Cambridge, Richie Pickett, who's a long lost kind of second, third cousin of mine. Anyway, we were like 18 years old, me and my friends, and we were first going to the pub, and we kind of knew of Richie Pickett because one of our classmates, Michael, was his nephew. Anyway, we'd long heard about this guy, and we saw him in the flesh for the first time in here. So we walked in there, you know, we were in the infancy of our drinking days. We weren't as good as we are now. We're very established now. Anyway, we went in there, my friend Dave bowled up to Richie, and we started chatting, and we were all kind of getting on. And Richie took a particular liking to my friend Dave and offered to buy Dave a drink. And Dave knew Richie was a bit of a rock star. Richie said to him, what are you drinking, Dave? Dave wanted to be cool. He knew Richie was a rock star. So Dave just said, whatever you're drinking, Richie. Richie looked at the barman and said, two glasses of vodka, thanks. So the barman poured two glasses full with ice of vodka, no lemonade, nothing like that. And my poor little 18-year-old friend Dave sat there and nursed this thing begrudgingly for about 30, 45 minutes. And yeah, that was our first impression of the dude. He was just, he was hardcore. He was a rock star. When Richie passed away far too soon, I remember he had his funeral at the Cambridge Town Hall, and it was like no funeral I'd ever seen before. There were heaps of bands and prominent musicians. I think Tom Sharplin and a couple of other well-known musicians, they got up and did a big concert. It wasn't really a funeral, it was a concert. Anyway, they had the aftermatch at the Stables Bar just down from the Town Hall. And to celebrate me, Michael Pickett, Richie's brother Peter, and my father, and I think Dave was there as well. We all got a full glass of vodka each and sipped that all night. So, yeah, the dude, he was an absolute rock star and gone too soon. But, I guess he's one of those kind of examples of quality over quantity. Not a long life, but he certainly packed a lot of good times and flavour into it, and the fact that we're still talking about him 10, 15 years later says a lot. So anyway, how Richie kind of relates to the tavern film was we have a character in the film called the Bar Rat, and he is like a wise old pensioner. He's kind of like the Yoda of the film, really, you know, the guiding light for these young rascals. Anyway, I wanted a guy called Mick Innes to play the Bar Rat, and we got him in the end. Anyway, Mick is probably most known in New Zealand for being the voice of Hammer Hardware. It's your local. He also did Home and Away, Shortland Street, River, Water Rats, all this kind of stuff. He was a real legend. Had a meeting with Mick. He was still kind of undecided. Had a second meeting with Mick, and he'd done a bit of research, and he kind of realised that he used to drink in this pub with his old buddy Richie Pickett. So obviously the acting, music world were combining to, you know, fritter away their days on a Tuesday being alcoholics. Anyway, I told him that I was a rally of Richie's, and Mick kind of, you know, took a shining to me after that. Like, he was kind of keen, you know, he was keen to come back and get into this old pub where he'd spent a bit of time, and I guess worked with somebody that had that larrikin spirit in him. So yeah, that was how we got Mick, thanks to old Richie. Yeah, memories of the Masonic. I mean, I guess when we were in high school, you know, like it was always that place you heard stories about it, you know, like it was a little bit violent, a little bit dark, a little bit dingy, you know, it had an air of mystique about it. I actually used to come here as a teenager at Cambridge High School, Wagging School. So my friend Gavin Stowe, his brother Ray, was the manager here for a time. So Yeah, so when we didn't feel like going to school, we'd wag up there and watch DVDs all day. So, yeah, they wouldn't let us drink any booze, obviously, because we were in our high school uniforms. But, yeah, we'd just fritter away the day watching DVDs up the top there. Anyway, when it came to actually coming to the Masonic, it was cool. It was fun. We'd kind of been going out in Hamilton with our older brother's fake IDs since about 16. So by the time we hit 21, you know, we were kind of over Hamilton and, you know, just keen to come here. And it was a good place. Many years later, like on reflection, I was having a deep and meaningful one time with one of the bar girls, and we were talking about the kind of clientele of the Masonic compared to the other places around. And she said it was like the home of the misfit in Cambridge. And on reflection, she was totally right, you know, like there was people that would go to the Stables or the Five Stags, but would never be brave enough to set foot in the Masonic, you know. So you always found interesting characters here, you know. You know, when you're in high school, like say third, fourth form, and somebody will get expelled or something like that, and you won't see them for years and years and years, this would be the place that you'd see them many years later, 25, 26, 27, here on a Thursday night, you know. It was just a magnet for misfits.
Best part about the Masonic?
Best part about the Masonic? Getting to watch for free some very hearty amateur boxing out here at about 2 a.m. I think the best part of the Masonic was, just the interesting characters, you know. You could get in here at 5 o'clock and have a beer with a tradie and talk some absolute nonsense, and then you're dancing in here at 2 a.m. With all the young people, you know. It had good variety. There was no pretentiousness to it at all. It was a bar for everybody, but it really did attract the kind of dangerous people, you know, which made it interesting. It wasn't safe. That was its appeal, I guess.
Was it busy? Was it a busy place?
It kind of went in ebbs and flows. Some nights it would be an absolute cracker. Walker Armour nights, it would always go off really, really well. There'd be so many people here. Some nights you'd come in here, though, and there'd be, I don't know, 10, 15 people. But generally, it was pretty good. It was pretty good. From Thursday onwards, there was always karaoke on a Thursday, which was pretty well attended. Friday night was always good, but Saturday night during those kind of winter months, the rugby season, people are drinking, you know, after the game at rugby. They're not going to Hamilton. They're too pissed to drive, so this would be the place. Some of the violence in here was pretty extreme. I saw a bit of blood. Saw a guy get glassed one night on a Thursday. But all the kind of folklore I hear was... It wasn't as bad as it was in the 80s. Apparently it was really, really bad. So by the time I was drinking here, it was pretty tame. But it definitely wasn't like Auckland bars. It was, a bit dicey.
People have this idea of Cambridge as this genteel, bucolic place that's a little bit like old England. Mm. But your film has shown the world that there's another side to Cambridge.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think every town kind of has its seedy underbelly. And to be honest with you, how Cambridge kind of sits now with its kind of bar scene and stuff, I think it's missing that seedy underbelly. I think in a weird, warped kind of way, it's important for a town to have its seedy underbelly. I think, you know, variety is the spice of life. When everything's like very homogenized and safe, it's boring, you know. The biggest sin, in my opinion, is to be boring in life, you know. And I just wish we still had a place that like kind of, you know, played some different music that was a little bit edgy, you know. We don't have that at the moment, you know. We've got some fine establishments, you know, the Stags, the Stables, all these lovely restaurants, but sometimes you just want to watch somebody from the Leamington Bees fight somebody from the Howtat Bees, you know. It's warped, but there's something kind of beautiful in that chaos, you know.
Your attraction to the Masonic, what does that say about Matt Hicks, filmmaker, film director, film producer, film writer, film actor.
Nothing too positive if I really think about it. The world isn't all roses and cherries, you know. There are some bad things out there, and some I've used this word a couple of times, warped characters out there. But I guess what it says about me is I'm attracted to naughtiness, I guess. I guess I'm comfortable about joking about anything because I don't hate anyone or anything. So yeah, you kind of, I get frustrated with those people. I don't know, I don't really like using the word woke because the whole woke thing is, it actually started with good intentions, you know. I get frustrated with the holier-than-thou types, you know. I think everybody calling everybody out and trying to cancel each other, blah, 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 it's almost like a holier-than-thou competition, you know, and I'm just not interested in partaking in that because I'm comfortable with who I am. I don't hate anybody, and I just like laughing.
So the kind of humour you deal in, it's just a classic Kiwi piss take.
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
Don't mean any harm, just using humour as a way to point out people's flaws and...
100%. Like, talking about, you know, we don't have much racism in the film. Actually, no, we do have a little bit of racism. But yeah, we're pointing out... how fucking stupid it is. We've got one scene in the film where one bloke, the big dumb kind of John Belushi-esque oaf, Keats, he talks about how he hates Indians, and everybody's like, whoa, 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 and he says, let me explain myself. And then he goes into this absolute idiotic tirade about how when he was young, he was playing with a cricket ball, it went behind the TV, he accidentally unplugged it, and his cricket fanatic father, who was watching this big climactic test match, ended up beating him with a signed novelty bat signed by some famous Indian cricketer. So yeah, absolute bullshit story. He then went on to say, that's why I don't eat curry and why I'm hesitant about some dairies. I was just a kid. But yeah, I guess that whole scene there is, there are some fucking stupid, racist, redneck fucks around rural New Zealand. And I guess that kind of scene is kind of highlighting those people and shining a spotlight on just how stupid they are, you know? Yeah, everything's kind of like got its surface level where you're just trying to get a laugh, but there's kind of like a deeper meaning in all the writing.
Subtext.
Subtext, that's the one I was looking for, thank you. I needed a journalist there.
And they do say sometimes the best way to change people is to shine a light, or show their reflection in a mirror.
100%.
Have you seen Mel Brooks's Blazing Saddles?
No, it's on the to-do list. I was a little bit too young for that. I kind of missed that, but it's on there.
The whole film is about racism. It's hilariously funny.
Yeah.
And it's taking the piss out of those particular types of rednecks that you're talking about.
I was watching some interview the other day. They were talking about that film Tropic Thunder, where Robert Downey Jr., they're in Vietnam or something like that, and he's doing blackface, you know? And I think it was made in like 07, 08, 09, somewhere around that time. And they were just saying you couldn't make a movie like that now, you know? Hollywood has become so safe, so risk averse, you know, so I reckon that's why the tavern's kind of like worked, you know, like we haven't had like a genuine good international comedy for so long, since that kind of like Will Ferrell, Step Brothers kind of 2010s peak, you know, and I think people have kind of like appreciated that, you know. We were at the Tivoli Cinema like every night getting people's crowd reactions and stuff, and one that I kind of remember is there was this old guy, he was like, I don't know, maybe 60 or something, and he thought he was off camera, and he said to our cameraman Dane, he just goes, that was refreshing, eh? And I really loved that. You know, I actually included it in our promo. Yeah, I think that's why it's worked, is because, yeah, people like laughing at stuff they shouldn't. And it's been nice to, you know, provide that for them. Oh, here we are at the Hotapu Rugby Club. So do I ever think about death? Yes, I do. And death, as morbid as it sounds, is a big motivator for me, you know. Being on my deathbed, you know, like, I want to kind of feel like I gave it my all. I think that's been the biggest satisfaction of doing this whole movie. Like, even if it was, like, critically kind of panned, everybody hated it, I'd still have that satisfaction if I got, like, hit by a truck tomorrow, that I'd actually done it. And that's such a good feeling to have in, like, your mid-30s, you know. It's so satisfying. Now, of course, I want more. I think that's the thing that we're always going to be battling with. There was a quote from Charles Bukowski, who was a favourite poet of mine and the bar rat McInnes. That's how we kind of bonded, actually. But he says something like, "You can't beat death, but you can beat death in life." And that's something that always kind of stays with me, you know. Like, I feel the more I make movies, the more I make people laugh, the more I satisfy my own soul by doing this, by making people happy, making myself happy, I am leaving a legacy and beating death in life. It's so important.
Do you believe in life after death?
Do I believe in life after death? Yes. Yes, I do. I'm not sure. We weren't really raised religious. I think my grandmother was a Catholic, went down here from my dad's side, and I think my mum's side were something else. So I think they, like, consciously decided to not raise us in a religious household. So, yeah, I'm pretty naive on religion and where, like, you know, what the rules are. But I think, I don't know, life's too good. There must be some greater power, I think. There's just so much cool stuff. The world really is amazing when you think about it. So I'd like to think there is a higher power, and I'd like to think, you know, if you live life to the best of your ability, be a pure soul as much as you can. There's a lot of corruptible forces out there. That, you know, hopefully your soul goes somewhere nice at the end of the day.
And if you haven't lived a pure life?
Yeah, I don't really like to think about it. I guess it's the opposite, isn't it? Be listening to Wagon Wheel on loop, that's my idea of hell. Yeah.
If you got cancer tomorrow,
yeah,
terminal cancer,
mm-hmm,
you had 6 months to live,
yeah,
would you stick it through or would you go for assisted dying?
I'd stick it through, 100%.
Why is that?
Just so I can be with my children for as long as possible. That's what excites me now. Like, I see career and family as two different things, but I'm really excited about, like, going to their 21st one day, about teaching them to drive, about going to their school plays, about doing all this kind of stuff, maybe playing some netball or rugby or whatever, you know. That's why I try to stick it out for as long as possible.
Are you afraid of the idea of dying?
It's something I actively try not think about. There's no point being scared because none of us are going to beat it. I think the thing that I'm scared of the most is not maximising my potential during my lifetime.
And leaving your children behind before they've found their own feet, by the sounds.
Yeah, 100%, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think you can definitely, if you've got the good support networks and stuff, like, you know, obviously thrive without a parent or whatever, but yeah, two's better than one, I think.
Have you had a serious death in your life yet? Have you experienced a serious death?
I've had a few friends go by the wayside. We had a couple of Cambridge people
around my generation passed away quite some time ago now. One dude, Kane Maxwell, he was working over in Australia and he got electrocuted. He died. He was really young. He had a young baby at the time. And then another dude, another Māori from Cambridge, Jordan Taurima, played with him here. He was over in Australia as well, and he, some like big heavy thing in the mines, like the strap broke or something, and he got squashed and he died as well. And he must have been late 20s or something like that. So, yeah, when you see those people go, and you're, you know, surrounded by your friends. We had another friend, a girl, Renee Vayers. She died, must have been last year. She was 38. Had a little one-year-old kid, her first, and yeah, she died of cancer. She tried to keep it going for as long as possible, and yeah, you never know when your number's up, so you've just got to, I don't know, just maximise, you know, just work hard, because it could be gone. Talking about Bukowski and stuff before, you know, like, I think that dude died in, like, 1994, and I only discovered him, you know, maybe 2016 or whatever, and I got really into his stuff. And to me, you know, like, he's alive. You know, he's alive through his work, his videos, his, you know, interviews you can find on YouTube. That is beating death in life, you know. And it'd be cool if people can, you know, like, watch the tavern in 100 years, you know, dip into the archives and be like, oh, okay, that's what the town was like back then, you know, that was the Masonic, that was how people spoke, and you know, that was the flavour of the day. That's beating death, you know. People watching a Charlie Chaplin thing, you know, that's beating death. He's still alive, you know. Marilyn Monroe is still alive, like, they're not physically here, but their presence, their aura, it's with us for all time. So yeah, the old Hotepu Rugby Club. So this is where the Datsuns, who have a film in the Tavern film, a song in the Tavern film. This is where they played one of their first gigs, I believe. So our old teacher from Cambridge High, which is just a couple of paddocks over, Marty Gleave, he was telling us the story one time that he went to the Datsuns' first gig here. They were called Trinket at the time. And he went to it. He said it was one of the worst musical experiences of his entire life. And he went up to the boys after the show and he said to them, boys, I really think you should concentrate hard at school, because after listening to you in the weekend, you're never going to make it as musicians. He ate his hat. He was extremely wrong. They were on the cover of NME, weren't they? In Britain.
Four singles on the British singles charts, an album at the top of the British album charts.
Yeah, so awesome, eh? It was so important for me to have the Datsuns in the Tavern film. It's the first song that we have in one of our opening montages. We've got Motherfucker from Hell. And yeah, it's just so cool to have this band that we were obsessed with as youths. So we all used to drink booze in a shed down there on Kelly Road, all of us Cambridge High people from the 2002, 2004 kind of generation, when the Datsuns were in their absolute kind of prime. We'd be sitting in this shed drinking double brown and smoking some Mary Jane and listening to the Datsuns, and yeah, it was cool. And to, you know, fast forward kind of 20 years later to have this iconic band and this film of mine, something I've created, is just so special.
Having a band like the Datsuns representing Cambridge, how did that make you feel?
Well, it made me feel like if they can do it, we can do it. It just shows that you can achieve something from here, you know. You don't have to live in Auckland, you don't have to live in Melbourne, you know. You can do it from here. So, yeah, those guys were kind of like a guiding light for us creative souls, you know, based out of Cambridge.
Did it give you a sense of pride?
100%.
The piss. And I've been watching the YouTube clips on YouTube, strangely enough,
yeah,
of the little sessions that you do after the film screenings and people talking about it. And of course, everybody's holding a can of piss. Now, tell us about that. Well, first of all, it's part of your fundraising efforts, isn't it?
Yeah, so obviously, you know, we made a movie in a pub. So for copyright reasons, we couldn't use Spates, Lion Red, Waikato Draft, all the usual suspects. So we had to make our own beer brand, and you know, the whole movie's a piss take, so we thought we'd call it Piss, which is you know, just a classic Kiwi term that's used every day.
So when you say we, are you saying you and other people involved in the film came up with the idea collectively?
Well, I did, but you know.
The Royal We.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is it a specially brewed beer, or is it just a generic beer in a can that you've labelled?
Yeah, so it's made by a company up in Auckland. They're called Epic. So yeah, I just had a connection there. And
so it's actually a really nice craft beer.
No, we don't use that word. I try to steer away from that, to be honest. Yeah, I told them to make it as close to Sign Lager as possible. I don't think they really nailed that. It's still good. Most people seem to like it.
So how many cans did you order?
So I ordered 1,000 cans, and I was a little bit worried, you know, am I going to sell all of these? So when we had our premiere on May the 26th, 2025, we had all three screens at Tivoli booked out for a 5:30 session, which were family, friends, cast, crew, all the kind of sponsors, well wishes, etc. And then at 7:30, it's what I called the Mongrel Influencer screenings. So I had all three screens booked out with like the biggest pisshead in like Cambridge, Morrinsville, Te Aumuru, etc., etc. It was a very curated kind of guest list, and we sold out half the piss on that night. So that was a tactic to just kind of like relieve the pressure, because after that, you know, you just kind of like sell a few cans here and there. Not everybody's heard of it. Some people had definitely heard of it, and that was maybe the deciding factor of them coming to the film or not. You know, a lot of people just wanted to come to get the can as like a little bit of memorabilia. So it's very Cambridge, this can. You know, we've got the Masonic on it, we've got the town hall, we've got the white church, we've got some horse stuff on there. Like, it's a really cool can.
Are you going to sell it commercially? Do you think there's enough demand?
Nah, I really don't think so. And that's just me being a cold, straight-headed kind of like capitalist, I guess. It's just not worth the effort and the margins and all that.
So 1,000 cans, how many have you got left?
I've only got about 6 boxes left. So we sold all those out pretty quickly because we were selling out every night in Cambridge. And then there was about a month where we didn't have any piss. But, you know, there were people still coming to the screenings. So, watch out, little man. So there was about a month where we didn't have any piss. And then we got some more piss brewed up just in time before we went to our South Island tour for the tavern. So it was so we got another 1,000 cans brewed up, and we got it the day before I jumped on a plane and we did this 5-date South Island tour. So my mate drove my hungry white van up to Auckland, loaded up 1,000 cans of piss, and drove my van basically in a 24-hour period from Auckland down to Alexandra. It was like 21 hours or something, this dodgy white van with all this piss. But yeah, we've sold piss to Dunedinites, Alexandrites, Tiarnowites, Oamaruites, all around the country at every screening we've done. So yeah, it's been cool. I'm going to keep a couple of cans as, like, you know, memorabilia. One to chuck in my coffin, maybe. but yeah, it's not going to be a long-living beer brand. it will be wrapped up, but it's been such a good marketing tool. And I think it's going to be a good thing as well. I'm always getting Snapchats from people who have it in their man cave or on their windowsill or something like that, you know, as a little bit of memorabilia, you know. I think what it's going to do, because we've got all our social media stuff on there, we've got our website on there, it's going to give the film a long tail. It's going to give it a long life. You know, somebody could see this can in 10 years' time in some man cave and be like, oh, but this, what's that about? Oh, it's this movie, The Tavern, da-da-da-da-da. They're going to search it up on the internet, watch it, you know. So just how we watch, you know, The Castle now, 20, 30 years later, you know, because it's been brought up in conversation. That's what the piss will serve to do, you know, hopefully.
How many tickets have you sold?
I don't know.
It'd be in the thousands now.
Yeah, 100%, yeah. I had a meeting with Gordon Wood, who owns the Lido Cinema in Hamilton, and just last week, and yeah, he said it was the highest selling self-released film of 2025. So I'm really proud of that. And judging on my own independent research, I can't say this confidently, but I think we're right up there for the highest self-releasing film in New Zealand of all time. But yeah, like I said, I can't confidently say that, but I think we're right up there. So that's really cool. And I had this awesome thing, must have been 2 weeks ago, where Andrew Cousins, who's the general manager of Madman, which is a big distribution company in New Zealand, he was talking about the state of the New Zealand cinema industry and talking about, you know, the success of Tina, 6.5 million. He was talking about the Prime Minister documentary, all these other things. And he mentioned us in his post. This is on LinkedIn. He said something like, low budget, self-release, The Tavern, outgross films, many films with 10 times its budget with its lean, savvy marketing. So I had all these cinema owners I've been dealing with, you know, screenshot this and send it through to me, and that was really, really cool. It was nice to finally, after all this hard work, all this travel, all this Facebook spam, all this stuff, to be recognised by like a prominent industry figure. So yeah, that gives me hope, and hopefully it's all up from here, you know.
Have you started on a second film? Have you started thinking about a second film?
I've started thinking, but I haven't put pen to paper. I guess I want to stay in the nonsensical lane. I think you've got to be quite the skilled writer with dialogue and all that to pull off a drama. I think if your film's a bit low budget and hokey, I think that's okay as a comedy, because people can kind of, you know, suspend their belief a little bit and kind of tolerate it. But I don't think people will tolerate a low budget, shitly written drama or horror.
Well, I'm pleased to hear that, because you're right, you are very good at comedy, and people who are way more informed than I have said many, many times over decades that comedy is actually the hardest genre to pull off.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it just kind of comes naturally when you just love laughing, when you are a person that revels in the ridiculous.
Now, just to go back to YouTube, when the film played in Auckland recently, mm-hmm. your Auckland debut, you made a promotional film with Mikey Havoc.
Yes.
And, well, it sparkled. It was well directed, it was well written. It was only, what, 5 or 10 minutes, wasn't it? But
yes,
it was hilarious. And Mikey Havoc was a revelation. He did Dr. Evil, but yes. He did it in a thoroughly unique way, that I haven't seen before. No cliches there. And I kept on watching that. I must have watched it three or four times the first time I saw it, and I kept on thinking, well, there's the germ of a new film.
100%. I reckon Mikey Havoc would be so cool to just like have in as a warped kind of character somewhere in a comedy, you know, just like one awesome scene, you know. It was so cool shooting that with Mikey. So just before that, you know, like we've had this ongoing kind of story throughout our whole marketing where we've refused to play our Bogan Country film in Auckland. This is due to the overpriced coffee and the fact that it's too hard to find a car park, etc., etc., playing up on all those stereotypes. So we did a mock press conference outside the town hall. Then we did another video where we said it wasn't economically feasible to play in Auckland, so we're going to the South Island. And then this was like the third video in our trilogy, you know. So I'm like, I gotta get a prominent Aucklander, you know. So we thought about like Wayne Brown and a few other kind of options, you know. But I'm like, who's somebody that really kind of like is kind of like an unofficial mayor of Auckland, like somebody that is proudly Auckland and just Auckland, you know. And that's Mikey Havoc. So pitched it to him, he was keen to do it, and it was honestly like such a thrill. He was like a real childhood hero of mine. So, you know, when I was at Cambridge High, like fourth form, I'd sit there on a Tuesday or Thursday night, and Havoc and Newsboy would be on, followed by Back of the Y, which was another massive inspiration for me. So to actually work with a dude who all my friends know and who's been a longtime hero of mine was just like, it was magic, eh? It was so magic.
What do you like most about Cambridge?
As cliche as it is, it's the people. We've got a lot of interesting characters, you know. There's characters like you, mate, you know, like you're an interesting character. Like you add a bit of like flavour and diversity to this town, you know. Like you're a I don't know, you're a deep thinking podcast hosting film star historian that also has to get out there and move some fences and you know, get his hands dirty. There's heaps of interesting characters. We've got a lot of good violent pubs, but we've got some really good eateries here. There's a good variety of things. The lake is beautiful. Even Lake Te Kuta, you know, like you don't want to look too close, but just having a stroll around there is beautiful. I love all the trees. You know, we've got a beautiful town centre. I'm not much of a cricketer myself, but I love that they play cricket in the town square there. The cafe culture's cool. I love, you know, you've got Paddock there and the deli on the corner. Like, the architecture's beautiful. I don't know, I guess I've just lived here my whole life that you just can't help but love it, you know. Like, Cambridge feels like a parent to me, you know. All of these different little, like, buildings and stuff where I've you know, got steamed up, you know. Like, they've got rich memories for me, and every place is kind of special, you know.
I do have a very bad habit of visiting Te Awamutu and Warrensville and Matamata and Te Araha, yeah, and going, and Hamilton, and yeah, going, not quite up to scratch. Matamata is actually very nice. It's very Cambridge-esque.
Yes.
Te Awamutu has potential.
Mm.
Warrensville's an industrial town.
Yeah.
Hamilton is...
you can't really compare it because it's a city, so it's kind of almost in a different class, you know.
It is, and it's a developing city. So you have an old traditional part of Hamilton in the centre, but it's constantly changing around the periphery. So it's not one thing or another. I do notice that I have to change my driving as soon as I get to Hamilton. I have to be more aware and put my foot down a lot more.
The funny thing that I find, because, you know, I DJ in all these different towns, Morrinsville, Metta, TA, etc., etc. You talk to people about Cambridge and you'll get somebody saying like, oh, you must be a snob then. Like, these outside towns kind of see Cambridge as snobbish or something, and I have never experienced that, you know. Yeah, it's just not something I've kind of seen. I find it quite hard to believe.
It is conservative, though. It votes national.
Yeah, but what New Zealand small town isn't conservative, really? They're all conservative. I found it quite funny when I toured the tavern, you know, we went down to the South Island and we played a show in Te Anau. So we sold out there, and before I get up kind of thing, I do a little speech and I encourage them at the 20-minute mark to dance to the song Bliss by the Dudes, and then we come in there with a video camera and film them dancing, and generally, 9 times out of 10, it's pretty good, you know, we chuck it on the social media and it's great marketing for us. The Te Anauites, they were like concrete bottoms. Not one of them got up to dance, you know. On our marketing, I think there was a swear word or something like that, and the Te Anau promoter for us like wanted us to take that down. Like, that is a conservative town. Cambridge is conservative, but I think the deeper south you go, in my experience, really conservative. I remember me and my friends, like, lovely, beautiful place, Te Anau, lovely people, but I just thought to myself, you know, like, I guess I'm a fairly conservative guy, but, like, I could not live that much of a conservative life down there. It would just be too boring. This street here, this would be one of my goals if I ever became the evil, corruptible mayor of Cambridge. I'd love for this to be, chuck a big long gazebo over all this and turn all of the street into restaurants and cafes and bars and stuff. Kind of like what Rotorua's got with Eat Street. I think that would be fantastic.
So we're on Empire Street, which is runs parallel to the main street of Cambridge.
But yeah, I think it'll be brilliant. Make it into our very own Eat Street. Central place, everybody could hang out, and might attract a few tourists from Hamilton and some of the other surrounding towns. I reckon it'd be cool. This is another little thing. this ladder here, after the Masonic, we'd try to climb up that ladder there and get up to that front deck. And this corner here is what we would call a behaviour corner. So everybody would drink at the stables and get a little bit tipsy and then make their way down to the mud. And everybody would be yahooing and stuff like that. And then you'd have a little team talk by the red phone box there and be like, right, we're coming up to behaviour corner. The bouncers are going to be assessing our wobbly walk. So just, you know, keep it together. And that was it, man. Behaviour corner. What a name.
And we're back where we started. Thank you very much for your time, Matt.
Thank you, Andrew.
And good luck with the next film.
Cheers, Matt. Thank you.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.